Welcome to Beyond the Code, AI and Law. I am your host, Letlhokwampedi. In our pursuit of innovation at the University of Johannesburg, we often speak about the fourth industrial revolution as a tool for societal impact. But what happens when the tool begins to invent its own reality? Recently, the South African legal community was rocked by reports of AI hallucinations, non-existent citations and fabricated judgments appearing in our high courts. Today, we are diving deep into the ethical and procedural quagmire of false AI-generated case law. Joining me is a good colleague who has been at the forefront of this research, Professor Michelle van Eck. Michelle, let's start with the why. We have seen cases like the recent one before the acting Judge Smith in the Gauteng High Court, where a tool called Legal Genius cited cases that simply don't exist. How does a sophisticated LLM end up lying to a lawyer?
What a wonderful question. Thank you. I think that the first thing we need to maybe just highlight as a starting point is that lying is maybe a strong word when we're dealing with AI, because we're trying to put a human characteristic to a AI system. But lying is perhaps accurate in terms of the outcome that we are perceiving with these systems. When we start looking at AI, and specifically generative AI, we realize that the system is built in such a way to try and accommodate requests. So it picks up on small micro cues in how we input information. But I always say these systems are like two-year-olds. They're trying to make the parent happy. They're trying to make the person that is inputting it happy. So these LLMs are trained on certain data sets, but based on what you input, it tries to give you what it what you want. So sometimes it may hallucinate or create fictions to accommodate your request. And we then perceive that as false information.
Now, Michelle, it's a paradox, isn't it? I mean, we want efficiency, but we are getting fiction. In your view, is this a failure of technology or a failure of a practitioner?
Wonderful. Yeah, it's a little bit of both. If I may just say that the technology obviously needs to tell us of its shortcomings. And back in the day, 2023, it didn't really tell us. But in today's world, with the more advanced Gen AIs, we know there's certain shortcomings. But I think the main situation and the main responsibility sits on the individual, the professional. And what's interesting, what we're finding is that as a legal profession, we have always had the duty to verify. We've always had this duty to check the information for accuracy. But technology, and specifically AI, has highlighted this duty because there seems to have been a failing. Perhaps interesting is that we are currently seeing hundreds upon hundreds of reported cases of lawyers just not doing this. Last week, I read that there's been 1,000 reported cases internationally. Of attorneys that have been reported or found out in using AI in unverified, and where they haven't verified the information. So for me, this has become one of the major ethical crises, if crises, if I can put it that way, in the legal profession in the last, I would say, decades.
This is crazy. Michelle, you have written extensively on this. I mean, your article last year in TAR, Dit Schreffer, the South African Sereg, Journal of South African Law, 2025, volume three. I mean, congratulations. And 2 days ago, you have written an opinion piece in the Daily Maverick on this issue. I mean, in our South African context, where the justice system is already under pressure, what does the introduction of synthetic evidence of fake authorities do to the public confidence on this issue?
Now, I think it's much, and you highlight a very important point, because it goes further than just an ethical duty. in relation to legal practitioners. If we start looking at the most recent case, the Northbound case, we see that the court has said that the use of fake information in courts is an issue of administration of justice, following the UK position on this. And it kind of makes sense, because if we introduce fictitious cases into a justice system that is based on precedent, we can exacerbate fake information.
That's right.
So certainly it becomes an administration of justice issue. And the court said there, it doesn't matter how remorseful the attorney is. It doesn't matter how good intentions they have. You have broken the system here. So I would think that the fact that our actions then have an impact on administration of justice, it would certainly impact a public perception as to whether the system, the legal justice system, actually works in this environment.
And what about the lawyers? I mean, you know, billable hours are a big thing. I mean, if a lawyer, you practice law. I mean, if a lawyer charges a client, you know, for hours that that lawyer didn't work, and they used AI, and then the next, I mean, it's unethical.
Yes, 100%. What we are seeing internationally with legal law societies is that they are starting to guide lawyers as to how they can bill. I was at a and I don't want to name or shame anyone, but
please.
I was at a organization event, and the attorneys and lawyers and legal practitioners there were thinking, wow, this is a quick fix to earn easy money.
Tons of money,
And it's not the case. What we're seeing internationally is that the courts, or at least the legal practice councils' equivalents, are saying that you're only allowed to bill for the amount of time you are spending on inputting the information and verifying the information, but you can't charge the full amount.
But so, Michelle, what about law firms who say, we've invested a lot of money in, say, building these LLMs, these large language models, or investing in whatever technology that we are using, so we have to recoup those costs?
Yeah, so again, that then comes to the attorney firm as to how they agree with their client. And there is more than just a per-hour billing system. There we can recoup the monies if we charge more fixed fees and so on. So it has also been addressed internationally. But I do think there is a reasonability in recouping that. But you can't recoup it unethically and dishonestly.
No, I agree with you. But, Michelle, we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bath water. I mean, you know, I always maintain that AI is like fire. You can use it to cook sumptuous meals, but it can also burn you. So far, we talked about the bad side of AI, but there's also a good side. I mean, in your latest piece that was published a couple of days ago in the Daily Maverick, you highlight both sides. This fellow whose lawyer walked out, you know, of his case, who relied on Google, and drafted some impressive heads of argument that he was complimented by the presiding judicial officer. Even the lawyer said, but who drafted this? And he won the case. Please tell us more about this. But you also flagged the other side, where the officers of the court cited false cases. Of course, not in that matter, but in other matters.
Yes. So I think with AI, and with any technology, any tool, it's how the human uses it.
That's right.
And in that piece that you were referring to, there are two sides to it.
That's right.
Mukunda, which was this lay person, this person that wasn't trained, used technology, specifically Google in that instance, to draft a well-crafted heads of argument, which eventually helped him win the case. But he did that responsibly. He did it with care and verification.
So in care that, and verification.
That's it. And in doing that, he allowed himself to, or at least placed himself at equal footing to fight this case. So technology gave him the edge, right, over and above the attorneys. But then let's look at the other side. Northbound, which is the other case in South Africa, and Mavundla, the properly trained legal practitioners abused it by not verifying, not checking, not making sure that the information is correct, and thereby impacting the administration of justice. So it's this human element that's going to make the difference as to whether we use it for good or for bad, if I can put it that way.
Yeah. Michelle, you and I are academics. I teach occasionally, but I'm still an academic. I do publish, and you know, we work at institutions of higher learning. How do we build a guardrail that allows for innovation without compromising the integrity, you know, in terms of our teaching and learning? But also, what message can we send out there, you know, to ensure that there is integrity for the bench, for example, and for legal practitioners?
Yeah. So I think there we need to again understand this is a tool.
Yeah.
AI is a tool like any other tool. It's the human element that's the problem. So those guardrails must sit with the human element, the way we use it. So we're seeing things like codes of conduct that's coming up, which we don't really have in South Africa at this point in time. Training, for example, is quite important.
Yeah.
But we haven't really placed that as a priority. We're not really seeing it in the education space as a priority in terms of training. Yeah. We're not seeing it as a priority in the Legal Practice Council. Right. There's been a little bit of rumblings of potential codes of conduct updates, but not much.
Yeah.
So those guardrails needs to sit with the human element. How do we make sure that when we use it, we use it properly and ethically and correctly?
Agreed. Michelle, I mean, you practiced, you served articles. Of course, before you can practice, you have to serve articles of clerkship. I went straight into academia. But, you know, for a young candidate attorney, if that young candidate attorney today was to approach you and say, Michelle, please advise me, I'm tempted to use ChatGPT, the pressure is too much. What would you tell her? What would you advise that young candidate?
The pressure is real, right? I think that we need to acknowledge that, especially in legal practice now. But my advice is, like with anything, there are no shortcuts, and there's certainly no shortcuts to success. Use the AI as a tool, like anything else, but you have to verify. Ultimately, your brand, your reputation sits on the output that you're giving. And if you start compromising on that, you compromise not just for your client, but who you are going to be going forward. You're building your brand, your reputation, who you are. And you need to guard that ferociously. And that is verifying, checking, have pride that when you know that you're putting this forward, it is accurate. I'm not saying don't use AI. I think everyone uses it, but use it responsibly. Failure to do that can impact not just your client, but yourself as well.
Wow. Use AI responsibly. There's no shortcut to the top. You know, there's an African saying that you can't climb a palm tree with your hands in your pocket. So use AI responsibly. Michelle, it seems the old legal maxim remains truer than ever. Trust but verify. Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your insights on how we can navigate this digital frontier without losing our ethical compass. You know, when I was a law student, and I think also when you were a law student, we had a specific module, legal ethics. I think that module on legal ethics should put more emphasis on legal ethics in the digital age. A lot of focus should be on legal ethics in the digital age.
Agreed.
Your thoughts?
Yes, agreed, 100%. If we look at the SACWA requirements, ethics is an important part, but it's wide enough to encompass AI. And like I said at the start of the session, I think AI and technology is one of the biggest crises that we sit with in the legal profession. We need to prepare our young future lawyers to be able to navigate this, and how much better than dealing with that at a undergrad level. So I agree with you 100%. There needs to be some emphasis on this.
Wow. Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your insights and spending time with me. And our viewers and listeners. Thank you, Misha.
Thank you very much.
Today, we are moving away from complex algorithms for a moment to look at something much smaller, but arguably just as powerful, the emoji. What started as simple smileys have become a universal language, but in the eyes of the law, a thumbs up or a wink can be the difference between a binding contract and a misunderstood joke. Let's dive right in. To the average person, an emoji is just a fun way to end a text. But we are seeing these icons appear more frequently in courtrooms. How is the legal system currently categorizing them?
What a wonderful question, because what we're sitting with at the moment is that emojis are becoming part of our communication.
Right.
So we're seeing this coming up more and more. The problem is that our courts haven't really responded, and our legislature hasn't really responded. And there's a really good reason for that, because emojis is just a representation of a thought or an idea, or more accurately, an emotion. And like with any other word, it is just a representation.
Right.
So the problem we sit with is ambiguity.
Yeah.
And the difficulty of pinning down what these things mean.
Yeah.
So our courts, and I speak from a contract and legislative and regulatory perspective, have interpretation rules for language. But the difficulty is, because of the uniqueness of emojis, those rules don't necessarily align.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, there's not really much at the moment that's regulating this area.
Yeah, and it's getting complicated because, I mean, I'm an Android guy. Someone else, you know, might be, you know, with other products. I sent you an emoji of a bottle. On the other side, it appears as a knife, and then it becomes a problem. Then we're left with a serious issue there of, you know, what did I send you? Michelle, we have seen cases recently, specifically in Canada, but even emerging discussions here in South Africa, where, for example, a thumbs up, a sharp, was ruled as a valid signature for a contract. Is the handshake deal being replaced by the emoji deal?
So, interesting enough, I think that the media has perhaps exploded that case, particularly because, yes, the court did take the emoji into account with concluding the contract. But when you start reading the case, what the court did is it was in the context of a long string of actions.
Right.
So there was a relationship between the parties, and there were similar type of texts.
Right.
Maybe not emojis, but things like, okay, sure, let's go ahead. And the court took that thumbs up and viewed it in context to what the individuals did in the past. So I think the important thing we need to take from that case is the emoji in its isolation isn't necessarily the acceptance, but it is in the context in which it's used, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think it's a replacement. It's just how we're going to use it in the context of a deal or a relationship.
Yeah. Well, context is important, and one could also add a culture, which is of course part of the context. Take you know, my wife always says I say a lot, and I nod a lot, and it's how one is raised. Because in a conversation, I have to acknowledge you to say I hear you, but it doesn't mean one agrees with. I of course agree with everything you're saying, but outside somebody may say you agreed that, whereas I meant I hear you. But I don't agree. So context is important. Michelle, that brings us to the risks. Beyond contracts, there is the issue of criminal law and employment law, which is my area, of course, employment law. A fire emoji or a knife can be interpreted as a threat or harassment. Mm-hmm. How do we solve this problem that you have just mentioned of ambiguity?
Yeah, I think with emojis, we need to remember that it adds an emotional layer to the communication.
Emotional layer.
In terms of that emotion, it is connected to a wider connection. So right. we've mentioned this. There's a cultural connection. Yep. There is a societal connection. There's a generational connection.
Generational connection is important.
So Gen Zs, for example, if you don't use emojis, it may be viewed as being quite aggressive versus, let's say, the boomers, which don't necessarily use emojis that much, may view it in a different way. So when we're looking at the use of these emojis, we need to look at greater context. We've got a couple of cases, such as in Australia, that's come out, and that was a defamation case where a individual posted a link to a person's hearing, and they put up an emoji with a zipper across the line, so not saying anything. And eventually the person was found guilty of defamation by just putting up that emoji. Interestingly enough, the court in that instance looked at the context of other people's responses to that to consider how they perceived it. So ambiguity is not going to be fixed whether we use it or not, but it's how we're going to interpret it. So potentially interpretation rules can assist us with that. Which opens up a whole other can of worms.
Yeah, but somebody putting an emoji with a zipper, it could create an impression that this person says something that that person doesn't say at that stage, or I reserve the right to say something at an appropriate moment. Okay. So it creates, well, it's complicated. In the workplace, there is, you know, this issue of, you know, line managers, you know, in terms of how line managers now should relate with subordinates. And now I'm wondering if a line manager sends a wink, for example, to a subordinate, is it friendly? Is it sarcastic? Or is it evidence of a hostile work environment?
So I, obviously, you'll have a little bit more from a labor law perspective, but I think the important thing here is that the emoji itself is not the evil in the room, right? It is connected to a whole string of either events or interpersonal dynamics, if I want to call it that, power dynamics. All of that will influence that interpretation of that wink. In a platonic environment, that wink is maybe fine.
Harmless.
But in a power dynamic where there has been...
It's out of the blue, a wink.
Exactly. It could be a problem. So the emoji, like I said earlier, adds the emotional layer. It adds a communicative layer, but it doesn't work as good or bad in isolation.
I think it's best for line managers to stay away from sending winks to subordinates. I think that is the safer option. Michelle, as this is beyond the code, we must talk about AI. We are seeing AI tools that read sentiment. Can AI help lawyers decode emojis, or does it add another layer of risk?
Yeah, so I think with AI, when we're starting to look at things like generative AI or even agentic AI, which is the newer portion of the development, there's this tendency to want to use it to get through a lot of information. But the problem is that, again, this type of system is designed to accommodate the prompter. It wants to make things... put things across in a way that makes you happy. Right? So there are micro expressions, micro emotional expressions in the prompt that the AI can pick up. So if I, for example, say, is this defamatory? It's already leading the AI to say it should be defamatory.
Right.
So there are micro expressions. I think in terms of AI, we need to be very careful. Because we may actually have a situation where we inadvertently getting the outcome we want, number one. And number two is AI can't really read these human emotions. So we might have things like certain lexicons and and encyclopedias on it, but it doesn't connect to, again, like we said, the interpersonal relationships, the societal, cultural, generational layers. It, it simply cannot read on that.
So the human element remains vital, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. We can't let the algorithm decide what a smacking face means in a high stakes, for example, litigation.
100% And even going further to that is, which algorithm are you going to use?
Yeah.
Because if I use Grok, I might have a different outcome to, let's say, Claude or ChatGPT. It depends on the training data. So again, the human side of interpretation cannot be substituted by these AI systems.
Incredible. Michelle, as we wrap up, what is your one piece of advice for professionals navigating this digital lexicon?
Wonderful. I think there's a twofold answer to this in terms of my advice. One is obviously within a legal profession and a business environment, try and be as professional as you can. Right? Emoticons are a problem if you're going to use that, and try and avoid it if you can. But there is the other side of it. As we see the younger generation coming up and being included in the workforce, their culture, their societal upbringing is the use of emoticons.
Right.
So the failure of using it might have an unintended consequence. So we can't run away from it. Either we're going to see it within the workplace, or we're going to see it with our clients, with people using it, where we're going to have to resolve the issue. But be conscious that emoticons are ambiguous and they are difficult to navigate. And I do think that our future professionals need to start thinking about putting something together in terms of how do we interpret these types of...
Yeah. Is this something that perhaps we could regulate at workplace level with, codes of conduct, or as part of our codes of conduct policies at work, perhaps?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, we do have at workplaces, let's say, language policies.
As part of that.
So we can certainly say that either remove the use of emoticons at a workplace environment, or say that these are the meanings. We can certainly do that. That will resolve a lot of issues. I do think going further than the workplace, we do need that from a regulatory perspective as well. The current lexicons and the current encyclopedias for this, that doesn't take into account. But I think from a workplace perspective, that's quite important, because you can regulate it there. But at a larger cultural perspective, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah. Wise words indeed. Michelle, thank you for joining us today and for shedding light on the legal weight of our smallest digital characters.
Thank you so much.
And to our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Code. Until then, mind your emojis and stay curious.